Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Just a quick note on our programming today before we get started. Today is actually the last day we're going to be recording from the studio until further notice, given the COVID-19 outbreak. We're going to be doing our best here at Eating Matters to record remotely and making sure we're still able to proceed with our regular programming. So thank you in advance for bearing with us. Okay, now to the topic at hand. Today we're going to be talking all about aquaculture or farmed seafood. It's one of the most efficient ways to produce protein, and it's helped improve nutrition and food security around the world. And yet, it's an industry that still continues to face challenges and criticisms. Today we're going to learn a little bit more about one company, Quarry Arctic, which is a third-generation salmon farm located near the Arctic Circle. This company is on a mission to evolve open water salmon farming into a sustainable practice that protects the environment and also promotes animal welfare while providing a healthy source of protein for the growing world. Joining me on the line today to get into all of this and exactly how the company is living up to its mission is Quarry Arctic CEO Ulf Knutsen and Jen Bushman, who's a sustainable aquaculture advocate and consultant for the company. Ulf and Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you guys were supposed to be with me in person today, but unfortunately, given the circumstances, you're not. And Ulf, you are broadcasting from Norway. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
It's late.
Yeah.
It's late. I know. I was going to say it's very late. Thank you so much for joining me at this hour, especially. And I hope you guys are both doing well. Okay, so let's start. Ulf, when was this company founded and by whom?
So the company, Kvare Fiskeoppdrett, was founded by my, the father of my father-in-law in 1976. So it has quite a long story to be as a farming company in Norway, one of the oldest one, still a family company in the north of Norway. So it's part of the, I'm married into the family.
You married into the family. Did you have a background as a fisherman or?
No, I don't have a background as a fisherman. My father was actually a fisherman. So I have a fishing story in my family, but I was not supposed to be working in a fish company, actually. My story is that I met my wife at teacher school, and that relationship led me to meet her father that saw something in me, and he hijacked me before I became a teacher. That's how I ended up in Quarry.
In the industry. Where is this? Where is Quarry? And am I pronouncing that right? Quarry?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, you know, it's good. Hard for us Americans.
Yeah, I know, especially we have the O with the line through, and that's not easy. But
what is that?
We're actually located right on the Arctic Circle in the north of Norway. So Yeah, north of Norway. It's in middle of Norway, actually. But we have we don't have an Arctic environment, but it's quite north because of the Gulf Stream. We have a very good and warm and not so snowy environment, except for today. It's quite snowy today and windy. Yeah.
So and it's an island.
Yeah, it's a. It's a small island just outside the coast of Norway. You know, Norway has a lot of islands, especially this area has a lot of islands. Actually, in this county, there's 1,300 islands, where only 10 of them are inhabited. But if you go 50 years back, there were like 50 of them were inhabited. So it's in Norway, we tend to live where there are, where it's possible to live. We even have a TV show called "Where No One Thought Anyone Could Live."
And that's where you live?
Exotic. Yeah.
Okay. So, and I've read that your location is perfect for salmon farming. Why is that? What are the conditions that make it so perfect?
That is correct. It's you know, we have the Gulf Stream coming up from the Mexican Gulf, so we have. We are north of Iceland even, so we should have a colder environment because of the Gulf Stream. We don't have that cold environment. The coastal environment on where we are a bit warmer. So if you go inland, of course, it's very cold. But here we have a perfect environment for farming because the fish thrives when the temperature is between 8 and 12 and most of the year, that's the temperature. But we have, at the lowest, we have 3 degrees, and at the highest, we have 15 degrees. And, you know, the salmon stops eating at under 2 and over 15. So it's quite exceptional. And it's the best area in Norway for farming because of, not only because of the temperature, but also because of the islands and the hidden places to farm without the open sea being a factor for bad weather. So,
For bad weather. And just to be clear, like 3 degrees Celsius is still, you know, it's like 38 degrees Fahrenheit or something. So it's not balmy.
Yeah. No, it's so warm. I understand that. But, you know, the fish doesn't need, it doesn't use any feed to regulate the temperature or anything, so it can eat and grow still if it's 3 degrees. So that's unique for an animal.
And we're going to talk more about what you feed the fish, but I just to kind of further sort of set the stage. So Quarry sounds like it's a remote island with a really small population, right? Yeah. How many people live there?
At the moment, we're 85, I think. We haven't done a counting in a while. It's 85.
And is everyone on the island dedicated to the industry or work for the company?
No, absolutely not. We have 26 employees, and out of those, we even have 7 people that commutes from the mainland and out to the island. So other businesses on the island is there's actually a staircase factory. There is one guy making salt. There's another company that makes seaweed snacks. And there's the school, kindergarten, the shop, the restaurant, the pub. So they are a quite active environment. And also fishermen, of course, yeah. So we are, yeah.
Okay.
So
it's, Ulf is the CEO of the travel bureau, so he has to promote all of the activities on the island. So when all of this lifts, if you want to be able to go to the island, the tourism board, you can reach out to Ulf.
Yes, thank you, Jen. Yeah, that's perfect. I feel like Norway is like particularly like not excited about the idea of Americans coming there right now, given our lack of.
Not at the moment.
Yeah, the lack of appropriate response by our federal government in containing and tamping down this outbreak, but with good reason. Okay, so this company, I read that it started with 3,000 fish. Your grandfather-in-law. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. So it started with 3,000 fish. How big is the operation today? How much has it grown?
Yeah, it has grown a lot. It's we're just above 2 million salmon per year.
Wow.
So it's okay. But still, you have to understand it. We're a small company in Norwegian farming industry. I think we're 0.4%. Huh. Of the Norwegian farming industry.
It's
around 1.2 million metric tons a year, and we are only 8,000 of those.
Huh. Wow. Okay. That's surprising, especially given some of the supplier relationships you've developed, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But now let's talk a little bit about aquaculture kind of in general. Jen, you're an aquaculture specialist, I know also. So can you just kind of give us a really brief overview of the types of aquaculture available and what types Quarry is implementing right now?
Absolutely. I mean, the reality is, although a lot of people make that choice, you know, is it farmed or is it wild? And they have this bad feeling about farmed fish in general and shellfish. But the truth is that we've been farming fish and shellfish for hundreds of years. And I mean, King Kamehameha used to farm kompachi off of the coast of Kona. So this has been part of our food heritage, but at scale has really only been done since the 1980s as that industry has grown, and particularly as the demand for salmon has grown. So to give you an idea, there's over 200 million metric tons of fish and seafood that's either harvested or reared. So harvested from the ocean and the freshwater stocks, or raised. And of all of that, it's about 55 to 60%, depending on what statistics you're reading, that's raised fish. As a matter of fact, in the United States, we have almost 65% farmed fish and seafood. And the species are broad. I mean, Atlantic salmon is one of the leading ones. Of course, we love our oyster farmers. There's kompachi, striped bass, branzino, barramundi, many, many cod, even now yellowfin tuna. We're really making amazing advancements in sustainable, ethical aquaculture. And that's one of the reasons why I love working with Quarry Arctic so much, because this is a program that really has been best in class and leading the industry in these innovations to make farming better and better and better.
Wow, that's amazing. I was one of my questions was like, how long has aquaculture been a thing? And I feel like you checked that off. You answered both the very historical perspective and also as an industry, you know, since the 80s. So good to know. When we talk about aquaculture, though, I think the perception is for a lot of people, like these pens in the middle of like a field or, you know, inland basically, with like a lot of fish kind of crowded around. But that's just one type of farming, right? And certainly, and we'll get into kind of like, I want you to kind of walk us through and paint a picture of what your operations look like. But what are the other types? Like, where else can you raise fish? Like in the open waters, in what other environments?
Well, I mean, I think the one that everyone will recognize is the heritage trout. You know, trout in the United States has been raised in raceway systems. Imagine long, almost like swimming lanes in a pool separated by a cement divider. Mm-hmm. And the fish will literally race from one side down to the other. And we are raising those fish in either state-owned fisheries or raceway systems or privately held groups like like riverence trout. And these fish are raised from egg all the way to harvest on land. There are also pond systems. Think of raised pools. You know, your grandmother used to have the raised pool that they built in the backyard. and there are fish that are raised in that, like tilapia. Mm-hmm. And then we have the ones that we love to think about in the U.S., oysters and the beautiful oyster beds, you know, this regenerative aquaculture with sea kelp and seaweed and oysters and mussels, similar to what they're seeding the Hudson Bay with, to begin to start to see that regenerative effect on the water, to cleanse the water. And then we have open ocean net pen farming, which is one of the most important. And I will say this, the world is 71% water. So when we look at the total amount of existing open ocean and lake water, if we farm on those waterways instead of ways that we set up on land, if we farm on those, we only have to farm on the size of water, the size of Lake Michigan, in order to be able to give the wild stocks a break, be able to replenish our oceans, and be able to raise enough protein for the growing population.
Wow. Why has this production method kind of gotten a bit of a bad rap in the past, though? What was the catalyst for that?
I think a lot of it is just, you know, in the old days, if I were to look at commodity farming, I think our narrative around land-based farming was a good one. My grandfather was a third-generation cattle rancher. My great-great-great-grandmother was one of the first women to ever settle on rural Colorado on the Eastern Plains. And I have a picture of visiting that ranch and seeing cows that were healthy out on the plains, beautiful corn waving in the wind. And that's my image of what land farming looks like. Mm-hmm. When I go into a grocery store, my image as I see, you know, whether it's beef or I see that corn, goes right back to that romanticized image of the farm. We don't have that image on water. Part of the issue of something being commoditized so quickly is there were a lot of bad farming practices. Technology wasn't where it was today. We didn't have the feed models. All of those things that have really increased and really made better farming methods. Just like now how we can raise chicken well and we can raise chicken badly. That's no different over the course of those couple of decades as it is for aquaculture.
When we think about the Quarry specifically, is this considered open ocean or because it's kind of like protected? I mean, is it in the fjords or is it in the like wide open? What kind of, where does this type of aquaculture fall?
No, it's we have avoided the fjords actually because of our experience with fjords and environment and how the water is changed and everything, it's not optimal for farming. We are in open waters, where in between islands, of course, but it's open water flowing through all the time. It's not like the fjord is being, it's a loop of water going around in the fjord. It's north and south. So our farms are in open waters, protected open waters.
Okay.
And just to define it, yeah. Mariculture is going to be deep ocean farming. We have a couple of great examples of that. Blue Ocean Mariculture is raising kampachi off the coast of Kona in these nets that are completely submerged under the water. Open Blue Cobia, they're doing the same thing off of the coast of Panama. That's something that is going to start to grow as well. And remember that the ocean, if we can move, we want water that's really moving, right, that's churning, that's getting the fish to swim and get a lot of exercise and moving a lot of fresh water through it. You know, everyone should understand there are less fish in a fish farm pen than there are when the fish school together. It's usually only about two fish for every cubic ton of water.
So the open ocean, that's different than like the deep ocean is a different form. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay,
so we have the type of aquaculture where with Quarry Arctic, where mm-hmm. and then we have mariculture, which is in the deeper ocean.
Got it. Okay. Okay, great. Yeah. So let's get into kind of describing, I don't know which one of you wants to take this, but you know, to someone who's never seen this operation or anything like this, how would you kind of describe what it looks like?
Yeah, I can try to do that. It's It's the farms are, like I said, located in protected areas where actually one of the areas where we have three of our farms is the traffical route of the boats along the coast of Norway. So when you see a farm, it's from distance, it looks like, yeah, we have the barge, the feed barge flowing there. So it looks like a house actually on the ocean, just floating there. Mm-hmm. Many people believe it stands on the magnetic or bottom of the sea, but it's actually a concrete floating barge that contains all the feed, of course, and all the technology and everything to get the feed out and to monitor the farms. And then you have between 16 and six, we have five different farms, so between 16 and six pens on each farm. And each pen is around 90 to 120 meters in diameter, and then the nets underneath are between 20 and 25 meters deep. And then you have buoys that holds the mooring system and connects all the pens and everything. And you have feed pipes that goes out from the feed barge and out to all the pens. So what you see from the surface is just a small part of the farming. It's actually when underwater where you have most of it. They say you can have a Boeing 737 and put it inside one of the pens. That's how big one of our pens are.
Yeah.
And as Jennifer says, the fish has a lot of space, and we have even reduced the amount of fish we have in each farm to be under 2 kilo per cubic in each pen.
So how far away, there are five different farms, how far away are these different farms from each other on the water?
I can almost see all of them from my office, but okay. Still in Norway we have a regulated distance between the farms that mm-hmm. you need to have, so it has to be over 5 kilometers from each farm.
Oh.
So we have more than that between our farms, and we have the only farms in our area. So we are in a kind of our area of farming. There are neighbors around us, of course, but not in the distance that you can see them from our farms.
And how long does it take to grow salmon from birth to harvest?
Yeah, it depends on if you count from hatchery to harvest, but from we put it out into the sea until it's finished harvest, it's between 12 and 16 months.
Okay, okay. And do they spend their entire lives in one pen?
Yeah, we try to, because handling fish is never good, and handling them, moving them from pen to pen, we need to use a well boat or handle the fish, and that you try to avoid that because you want the fish to stay in water and not be pumped out until it's going to harvest for the quality and everything and for mortality and those things. We put out so little fish in each pen that they can grow until harvest size in each pen without moving them from pen to pen. So that gives them even more space in the beginning, of course, and when they are harvest ready, it's 2 kilo per cubic.
I read that salmon can have heart attacks, and that they're prone to them. Is that true?
Yeah, it can happen. That is true.
Poor guys.
All fisheries are in the wild. They are very what you call it, the English word for it. They easy to scare.
Yeah, so, skittish, yeah.
So, of course, our fish that has been breeded for so many years, it can take the boats coming, the feed coming, all of those things without being scared. But then you have fish that will have, will easy scare and then can have heart attacks, of course. And there are, I know there's a lot of farms that are in areas where they're struggling with heart disease on the fish and so on. We haven't had that problem in our area. And also breeding, you can choose stronger and stronger fish, of course. That's one of the issues, going back to what you were talking about, why farming is looked at the way it is. It is, if you go 20, 30 years back and the way we were farming then, it was not sustainable. The mortality levels were too high. The use of antibiotics and medicine were extremely high. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't sustainable done. And that's also, I think, one of the issues we have with in the U.S. with salmon farming is that Canadian farms and American farmers are a bit behind Norwegian farms when it comes to the development. The technology and the knowledge and everything, yeah, we are. And the breed, of course, is come longer in Norway than it has in the other countries.
How many fish are you raising at any... Oh, wait, you said, is it 2 million per year you're... Okay, got it. And then you touched on antibiotics being a thing that, you know, was used, not by you, but in the past of the industry. How do you... I mean, I get you. It sounds like you're not... Overcrowding is not an issue, so maybe disease isn't much of an issue, but what happens when one of your... with fish gets sick? How do you treat that?
We don't have any sickness. We have there in Norway, you know, in our area, we have fought all the diseases. So there is, if the fish gets vaccinated before it is put out to sea, and then so there's no issue with disease. And we are in the area where, if we get, for example, the ISA disease, that's a heart disease that's possible for, or a kidney disease that the fish can get, mm-hmm. then the rule is that you have to empty, you have to just take them out, all of them, to prevent
I mean, I think the thing that's important to note, there are a couple of things. One is Quarry Arctic, we have our own hatchery. It's called Quarry Smolt. Mm. Mm-hmm. So we're raising these fish from the brood stock, which is the moms and the dads, mm-hmm. the eggs all the way to what's called a fry sack, and then a fry stage, and then the smolt stage. And then they're moved out onto the water. There are a number of preventative measures. It's just like you would handle things naturally. Like if you were to handle, for example, we know now on different farms raising different types of vegetables that they'll put sheep on, in between the rows, or chickens, you know, to add nitrogen to the soil. In the case of Quarry Arctic, they actually raise a lump sucker fish. And these lump sucker fish, they live in these artificial kelp beds that are in the pens. And what happens is that in the wild, Atlantic salmon know to swim through kelp beds, and the lump suckers actually eat the sea lice off of the fish themselves. So this was something that was discovered through knowing some of the old fishermen in the early 1970s when the farm was just started, mm-hmm. and they started to take this method and bring it to the farm. So remember, you know, it's sort of like spraying a bunch of pesticides on a crop. That's a really easy, almost lazy way to do it, mm-hmm. to be able to make sure that your yields were high. Where you have a family that has been farming on this water, has known this water for decades. And I mean, this is the oldest finfish farm in the world in terms of one that's still family owned and been passed down from generation to generation. The kind of learning that they're getting about their area, their water, the miroir, what exists and what lives in that water is unprecedented. And finding, being able to find models, and you should, you know, you'll talk about the feed, but where you're really raising a fish that's healthier allows it to adapt in these ways. So I think it's such a different thing. It's why it's industry leading.
Yeah. What about, and I'm asking you all of these, you know, questions because I just like to kind of get a handle on like what happens if this situation arises, like, but that's really great to know about kind of how it's very controlled and you know, specific from the very outset. And the idea of lump suckers seems brilliant and gross, but brilliant. Natural.
Oh, if you see them,
natural.
They're so cute. Oh, they're so cute. Everybody should look on quarryarctic.com because they're really beautiful yeah. little fish. And they're, I mean, we say it's nature's car wash. No. It's pretty amazing.
So what about fish escaping? Has that ever happened? Or are they so happy they don't want to go anywhere?
No, it's when you have farms like this and you have humans operating them and everything, you will always have a thing happening. But we haven't had any escapes from our farms since I came into the company. I came into the company 15 years ago. I don't know if it has anything to do with me, but yeah, it's... we try to do everything better and try to do everything, so we don't make that happen.
But the technology is outstanding. I mean, you're talking about double netting systems with no yeah. copper antifoulant, which is so important that there aren't those metals in the nets, because that's not healthy. The way we look at it, we want to be healthy for the environment. We want to be healthy for the fish, and we want to produce fish that's healthy for you. So when we look at, you know, if you look at those as three different silos, you know, for us to make sure that the marine mammal populations, the other fish, the water quality, that has to be exceptionally healthy. That's, as Alf will say, we look at the water as our land. That's what we pass on to the next generation. So if we're using the right technology on the farm, the right netting systems, we won't have escapes. These double netting systems. If there was something that would happen, there are emergency nets that immediately will cover over those other nets. Things like having the nets cleaned. Now think of it like the automatic, you know, robo vacuum cleaners. They go along the outside of the nets and they clean the algae off of the outside of the nets so that more oxygen can get in the water. It cleans the algae off of the outside of the nets so that you get better flow through of the water. That's why they used to coat the nets with copper antifoulant, was to keep the algae from growing. But what they found was, in the bucket of bad for the environment, in the bucket of bad for the fish, having that type of copper antifoulant, it meant that the fish were not, everything wasn't well. And it also makes them a little bit loopy, their brain development. It was really inhumane. And so then when we look at, you know, I mean, ultimately the bucket of what type of fish are we raising that comes to market that's healthier, that's more nutritious, that doesn't have the kinds of, you know, toxins in it, and that has the highest omega-3s of any farm salmon. So every single step is looking at that entire ecosystem.
Did you say it was a robo fish? Is that what you said that does that?
There are two things. We have kind of a robo vacuum cleaner that vacuums the outside of the nets.
Yeah.
And Alf can talk about it. There are coming. We've been working with a company out of Norway that was originated in the United States, and they have these robotic fish that go into the pens and collect all of the data. So when you talk about not wanting to stress out the salmon, you don't want to be pulling out fish or walking along the flotillas of the pens. You need to keep things very calm, very zen for the fish, and they react when there's something in the pens themselves. So these robo fish, these robot fish, they mimic the salmon and mimic the motion, and they can collect data, they can look for sizing, all of the information that we need that we can't get unless we were swimming in the pens themselves with the fish.
That is so cool. That is just really cool. How did that partnership come to be, Alf?
Yeah, that's the funny part. The name of the company is Aquai, and they, as you said, they originated from San Diego, actually, and came over to Norway, and they are now setting up their operation in Norway. No, it came along because we are. We were in a TV show called National Challenge PBS called, not 60 Minutes, but yeah, oh, I don't remember the name.
Something like that. Yeah.
Right now, but it was looking at the seafood industry and farming industry, especially then, and the overuse of wild fish for producing salmon. And we were brought forward as one of the good examples. And out of that, these guys from San Diego saw that and had this robot that they wanted to do do things with to save the oceans. And they saw us as one of the most sustainable farming of salmon in the world, and contacted us and wanted to know if there was something they could do to help us develop what we are doing. And I'm a big fan of data, and the Norwegian farming industries hasn't moved forward there, and needs to move forward and needs to collect more data to know more about what we're doing and how it's affecting the salmon and why it's affecting the salmon and what we can do better. So bringing them to us and then setting up what we have today, the data platform that we have with all the sensors that we will be able to collect all that data from the nets within the fish school, it's going to be or is amazing.
Yeah.
And all the possibilities that comes with it. It's amazing.
If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. That's so interesting. So I understand that the way and what the salmon are fed is particularly important and like a source of pride at the company. So Ulf, can you tell us a little bit about the feed? Does it mirror what the salmon would eat in the wild, or what is it like?
That's probably stretching it a bit far, but it tries to give the fish the same healthy diet as it has in the wild. And we have been working now for 7 years, no, sorry, 8 years with BioMar to develop our own feed. So we have a feed that is produced only for quarry and is unique in the farming industry. It has moved so far that it's way beyond all the other farms and all the other feeds that are produced for salmon farming. And with the focus on the sustainability and with the focus on the healthy diet for the salmon. So we have gone the complete opposite way of all the other farmers. You know, farming industry is now using less marine ingredients and are reducing the omega-3 levels in the fish. Because the wild fisheries, of course, are scarce and there's not a lot of, or there's not more fish to get out from the sea. So instead of using more marine ingredients that are also expensive, they use more vegetable in the feed. So we have gone the opposite way. We have looked at how can we still have an omega-3 level that is natural, mm-hmm. without taking out so much marine ingredients from the ocean. So we are, first of all, we're using only cutoffs or trims from the North Atlantic production of fish, like mackerel, sill, herring, and cod, and we're using an algae oil to top it up and to get the omega-3 levels that we need. So we actually have a double omega-3 levels as a normal salmon would have. But we have the same amount of omega-3 that, or even a little bit higher than the wild salmon would have. So that's amazing. And doing that also, we have cleaned the feed for PCB and dioxins. We have a natural colorant.
What are PCBs?
Those are the toxic substances that are in the ocean that the fish will accumulate in the oily part, and it's part of the pollution that comes from us humans living here. So it's part of the ocean after years and years of pollution. So it's part of the fish, mm-hmm. and there are in all wild fisheries there are PCB levels in the fish, but it's mostly in the fatty part of the fish, and the fatty fish contains more PCBs than a lean fish. But it's a normal farming industry. We are under the levels that are regulated by the governments, but we have we have seen that this is something we could do something with. It's a win-win for everyone. We are taking the PCB and the auxins out of the fish, the wild fish, and then out of the salmon again, and the cutoff from the salmon will then be used in the chicken industry, and you have a circle of life there where you're taking out some of the PCBs. We're not taking out everything, but we're taking out our bit of it, and if everyone did that, we would have we would be at the same time cleaning the ocean. So it's a win-win for everyone.
What is the fish in fish out ratio that I've read about with what you guys do? What does that mean?
That tells you how much fish you're using to produce 1 kilo of fish, and we're at the point where we're using 0.48 kilos of fish to produce 1 kilo. So we're a net producer of a protein. And that's amazing also. A normal salmon feed is at 1.6 to 1.
So we are
way lower. And that's because we can use the Corbion algae oil, the cutoffs from the industry that will not go to human consumption and all of those things. And being able to reduce the fish in, fish out, and still double the omega-3, that's something that most people didn't think was possible. But it's possible when you use an algae oil and those things that sets you up.
Yeah. Okay, so last question before we go to a quick commercial break, but what happens after the harvest? Are the pens, I mean, I'm assuming they're cleaned, but like, do they go into operation immediately afterwards, or what happens?
No, the rules are quite clear in Norway for fallowing pens or fallowing sites. When you harvest out the site, you have to fallow it for a minimum of 2 months. We fallow the sites for a minimum of 6 months, and that's because we believe that the environment and the sites need more time to take care of all the feces and all the feces from the fish and make sure that we're not pushing the benetics or anything to a point where we're taking away life from the benetic or anything. It's part of our land philosophy where we want to take care of the land, and so it can be in a shape where we can hand it over to the next generation. So we make sure we follow them longer. We take up all the nets and everything and clean it. We take up all the mooring and make sure we clean it also. It's like making disinfected the farm and make it ready for the next generation. Mm.
The ocean has this amazing ability to replenish itself. And remember, you have millions of gallons of water that are always flowing through those farms.
Yeah.
So just like how we need to fallow on land and give the land a chance for those nitrogen and all of those wonderful minerality to replenish itself, we feel like giving the area a rest and following that same suit is important. And so it gives a number of opportunities, including being able to check equipment, making sure that everything is up to speed once you go back and you farm in that area. So it's just part of now standard practice. And remember that the water also is constantly checked, and that's and so they're checking pH levels, they're doing chem checks, and you never go back to an area unless it's come up to the natural environment, the state that it was in prior to your farming there.
Right, and I imagine you want to take so you're going above and beyond, and this is also true that it's, you know, they're open waters, right? So you don't necessarily own the waters. So you're making sure to, like, I mean, you know, to take every kind of precaution necessary to make sure that it's as pristine as when you left it.
That's exactly right. The way these concessions work, a concession is a license, is that this is something that is granted to you by the government, in some cases, depending on where you're farming, by the indigenous people. And so you have a responsibility for that. And if you're not being responsible, then you're going to have your concession revoked.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean meeting minimum standard is not enough for us at Quarry Arctic. So understand that we're not by any means comparing ourselves to the rest of the industry.
Of course,
we are setting our own standards.
Yeah. Okay, great. We're going to take a really quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, I want to talk more about getting the fish to market, what that looks like in the supply chain, and of course, how incredibly delicious it tastes. Stay tuned.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium to galas in the renovated Palm House and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lily Pool Terrace. Executive Chef Sarah Flynn's unique menu includes modern dishes with global flavors, with a focus on local and seasonal ingredients.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Quarry Arctic CEO Ulf Knutson and Jen Bushman, who is a sustainable aquaculture advocate. Okay, so I said that we wanted to talk a little bit more about the supply chain now. Yeah, so can you help me understand after the harvest, how do your fish actually get to market? So what happens after it's harvested?
It's not a long, it's a process. When we harvest it, of course it goes from the farm with a well boat to the harvest station, then being pumped up and through the harvest station and packed in boxes. Our fish goes before we send it to the U.S. to not send everything. We're sending it to processing in actually down to Germany at the moment to get closer to market. The fish needs 36 hours after harvest to mature and be ready to be, so we were able to pick out the pin bones and those things. So we truck it down there. It takes between 36 and 54 hours, and then it will be processed off on day two, and then on day three it will fly over and from all the main airports in Europe then and fly over to the U.S. and be distributed all over different hubs we have in the U.S.
So I should have prefaced this, but I am particularly interested in this part of the process because the fishing industry, as you guys both know, is incredibly opaque in terms of being able to trace, you know, where your fish came from and where it was processed and how and by whom. And, you know, that's a big issue that industry is facing. So I am particularly excited that you guys have so much transparency around this process. So it's also why I have so many questions. So, is the processing, do you oversee that part of it? Like in the operations, or you contract with somebody? Like, and by processing, do you break it down or does it go like whole to Germany?
No, it goes whole to Germany.
Okay.
We contract that out to a company in Germany. We don't own a part of that company, and that's a choice we have made to not do that, to contract and to only buy from the best processors in Europe and also in Norway.
Yeah.
And we don't oversee it, but we have strict regulations and then follow-up and inspections on quality with them to make sure that we get what we want out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I travel at least 4 to 5 times a year down to the processor myself, and then I have a team of people also in Norway that will follow them up and talk to them on a daily basis, because we are processing almost every day of the week. To make sure we have fish available every day of the week.
Wow. And so is it shipped? Mm. So in Germany, will they break it down? Like, will they fillet it or...
Yep.
yeah, they will. They'll do that all that in the fit, in the processor.
Yeah,
it depends on what the customer wants.
They break it down to,
I think that it's really important to know that. I mean, the customers, both food service and retail, that we're supplying in the United States, they have different types of cuts that they want. Some chefs only want to get whole fish. Mm-hmm. So in that case, the fish are going to be cleaned. Odds are they're going to be scaled and they're going to be shipped just like that. There are other customers that want frozen portions because that's their business model, or we call it a D trim, which or a C trim or an E trim. It's different types of cuts with the pin bones removed, the skin on, the skin off. So it really depends on the customer itself. What I will say is that you don't want to cut or fillet a fish right away. One of the things that is important to understand with any fish is that it needs to go through what we call rigor. And then once it goes through that rigor, it's easier to fillet and better. So it's a process that actually we're able to take advantage of. It comes out, it goes to the harvest station, it can go through rigor and transport, be processed. And then whether it's by cargo ship in the case of frozen fish, or in the case of fresh fish, by air cargo, passenger planes mainly, it'll come into the United States.
Interesting. So it's not always, it could be frozen, but it's not necessarily frozen.
Depends on what the customer wants.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, great. And then how does your location affect the distribution at all? I mean, you're what, like, did I read 8 hours away from Oslo? So remote. How do you get?
It's quite remote, that's for sure. No, it the trucks, like I said, they take 36 hours to get down to Germany. So mm-hmm. it's, and it has a lot of weather and everything, of course, affects the situation in the north of Norway. And,
yeah.
And trucking down and everything, it's not straightforward, that's for sure. But we have, we always have options.
Yeah.
There's always, and right now we're working on, train and train as a solution instead of trucking, because there are a lot of there's a lot of focus on trucking in Norway and that it's not good when you have the train option available and everything. So we are working with some of the cargo companies to be able to take the train down to Oslo and then truck it from Oslo instead.
Yeah.
And that will be more stable also, because the train, there's a lot that needs to happen before the train doesn't go. But when it comes to trucks and mountains and everything, getting over those, that's more of a problem.
Yeah.
But we have been lucky this year, and we've been lucky most of the time that we have had little or none problem with the trucking. But we always have several trucks on the road in mm-hmm. case something happens with one of them. So. Mm-hmm. That's also being smart and planning and having a very good logistics situation.
Yeah. So. Food is logistics, I can tell you from personal experience working at a logistics company in the food industry, which people don't realize. I think, it's not the first thing that comes to mind, but it's so complicated. And I feel like Murphy's Law always applies. Like, if something can go wrong, it it will.
And the customer doesn't understand any of the problem.
Yeah, I know. And the goal is they can't, like, you know, the goal is like they can't know. And so it's like whatever you have to do. But I mean, it is stressful. Then what are your, this is also a question near and dear to my heart. This is something that I have been personally working on with my own company that's been so hard, which is packaging. How do you package your fish? It has been so difficult to find like really sustainable sources, just for me, and we're not actually dealing with like raw food product, so I can't imagine that this is easy.
It's packing is of course a big issue when it comes to the fish industry and the way we're doing it. It's styrofoam is of course the big thing
industry.
And the big thing that works.
Yeah.
It has worked for many, many years. But it's, we believe it's, or I have known for a while that we need to find solutions for that. And we're working very closely with a company in Norway that has been able to produce recyclable cardboard boxes that can take the same beating as a styrofoam box and still keep the cold and everything and all of those things you look for when you're using a styrofoam box. And we're going to heavily test that and make sure that we're sure that it can keep the same and do the same as a styrofoam box. But eventually we also want to change the styrofoam, because styrofoam is going to be, it is not yet, but it's going to be forbidden at one point. There hasn't been any development in that industry for, I don't know how many years, but it needs, either the industry does something themselves or then they will be just changed out by recyclable cardboard boxes instead.
Yeah.
They can withstand the water and the beating and everything.
Yeah, and maintain and insulate. I'm looking forward to following your efforts on that, because I know how hard it is, but that's amazing that you're really being proactive on that front. I talked a little bit earlier about transparency and that you guys have, you know, a lot of commitments around this. How are you demonstrating transparency?
Yeah, first of all, we're trying to share as much of the information as possible. We have the Discovery app we have with BioMar, where you can go in and you can read all about the feed, all the ingredients, all the parts of the feed, where it comes from, how it's made, and so on. And then we are working on a blockchain project with IBM, Atea, a Norwegian company, to share everything that the customer wants to know about our production, and to be able to give them full transparency and full.
There's a website actually called discoverseafood.world.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can do is you can click on that and you'll be able to see all of the nutritionals on the fish, which is exceptionally important because of the feed model, because of the work that we've done with Corbion and with BioMar to have the most nutritious fish that is coming into market, particularly as it relates to omega-3s and long chain omega-3s, because there have been issues with the quality of the algae that's being used in the salmon farming industry. And although the fish need this very much in order to be able to survive and to have its brain development, to be able to fight disease, but it's been the quality that has been the problem. So it's not necessarily transferring over from a nutritional perspective as much as it should be. So all of the nutritionals, again, discoverseafood.world. And then you can also see full traceability on every single feed component. So someone would ask, well, where are your different components of the feed coming from? Well, you would be able to click on that and see that, you know, it's non-GMO, it came from this country. You can see where the algae prime, where the algae from Corbion is coming from. Every single thing on an ongoing basis, updated as we use it, is available there. And then you'll begin to hear more. There'll be a lot more coming on the blockchain, but I can tell you that this will be groundbreaking. It'll be the first ever blockchain program that's been used by an aquaculture company.
That's so cool. I'm really excited about that. I still totally don't understand how blockchain works, even though I've covered it, but when that fully, you know, is launched, I'll definitely have you guys back on to help me understand it better. Okay, so let's talk about the fish. Let's talk about how it tastes. What are the things that I should be looking for as a consumer? Like, how am I supposed to tell if a piece of salmon is good or not? Or if looking at the whole fish, actually.
Yeah. And Jennifer, you're better at telling this than me.
If I'm looking at the whole fish and I'm, you know, a discerning chef or consumer, there are going to be some things that are kind of what I call the low-hanging fruit. First thing is you hear that you're supposed to look for clarity in the eyes and that the gill tag should be bright. I mean, the gills, excuse me, should be bright red.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, those are the things that really only, both of those actually, if the fish at all is exposed to oxygen, you can get some browning of the gill tags and the eyes can become cloudy. That doesn't necessarily mean that the fish isn't fantastic. So there are some other things that I actually look for. I make sure that the scales are intact, that the outside of, and if it is scaled, that the skin is very shiny and bright and beautifully silver. I look and make sure that if I can touch the whole fish, I make sure that as I run my hands down the body, that I can't feel any soft marks, that it's very firm down along the body. You'll see in a farmed fish, it's very, very important, and you see this on every single quarry Arctic salmon, that the fins are well developed. A lot of poorly reared salmon will not have the dorsal fin and the other fins, that beautiful center fin, fully developed. And if the fin is developed, it means they're exercising. So if you think about a muscle being developed, if you're not out there exercising and it's not in that water and the water's not really churning around, or if the pen density is too big, meaning there are too many fish on the farm, then they're not going to get the exercise that they need. And one of the things that I thought was exceptional, the first time that I ever saw a quarry Arctic salmon, and Alf may not even have heard me talk about this yet, was the development of the muscle all the way into the tail fin, that a lot of times on, whether it's a wild or a farm salmon, you don't see this really well-developed muscle that literally almost touches the edge of the tail. It'll sort of stop and you'll have more tail on it. The tail should be fully formed. On a salmon that is poorly reared, sometimes the tail won't form or it'll be eaten off by the other fish because the density is so tight. So when I'm looking at a quarry Arctic salmon, I'm going to see bright eyes. I'm going to see beautiful bright red gills. I'm going to be able to feel it and be able to feel that the flesh is very, very firm as I go down the body. And then when I fillet it, I'm going to be able to see that it's bright red, that there's no softness. It's firm, and that there's no softness down the center of the fillet, that the fat, you see the fat lines in it, and the grain of it is very well defined. And of course, the aroma should be something that is very much like the sea, like the Marois. It's going to have this fresh, clean, almost sea aroma rather than it being fishy at all.
Wow. Okay. That is such a good description, Jen. There's so much information. I love it. So impressive. Okay, so I'm assuming that quarry's fish all looks like this, like how you described.
It absolutely does. I would say, I mean, the majority of the fish, here's what we want. At least my goal is that every single fish, when it's first being looked at by a buyer, by a chef, look at it whole, because I want you to see the structure of this beautifully reared animal. You know, I mean, we make sure that all of the care and effort from the egg all the way to harvest is done. And the way you see that best is if you see the whole animal. Then from there, most of the customers will end up ordering it, frankly, by far as either a D-trim or a C-trim fillet. Mm-hmm. That means skin on, pin bones removed, and you're going to just see the fillet. When you look at that fillet, if it has that deep orange, it has that clear, beautiful grain, that bright aroma to it, then we're well on our way, right? I mean, at that point, we can talk about what the nuances are as you taste it. And this is no different in my mind than wine. I mean, mm-hmm. There are so many different layers. An oyster, depending on what region of the ocean it's raised in, is going to take on different layers of flavor, just like terroir with wine, merroir with the water and the raising of our fish on this beautiful, clean, clear Arctic water. And the brightness and the cleanness of this fish, firm from a texture perspective, but then also a clean mouthfeel. It's not overly fatty, but it is buttery, and it doesn't have any sort of residual flavor on the palate. So once you swallow it and you kind of have, you know, taken that moment back after getting a bite, it's very bright and clean, fresh flavor on the palate. So it doesn't, for those that are going to be cooking quarry up at home, you won't smell it cooking. And a lot of consumers won't cook fish at home because they don't want it to stink up the house.
Right.
That's, you know, well-reared fish means that you're going to have something that's very clean, very bright in aroma as well as in flavor.
And then first of all, where can you get it? Now you just announced a very big partnership with Whole Foods, right?
Yeah, we have.
Yes.
Whole Foods is, has taken it into four regions, mainly in the Midwest and the North. Canada, North West. Yeah.
So Whole Foods in certain regions, and then we also have food service. So there are a number of distributors that are distributing it now in New York and beyond. We have some great partners with Compass Group and Foodworks in Chicago and others. Remember that we only brought Quarry Arctic into market on February 1st. Yes, there was this relationship through another distributor that brought it in unbranded into Whole Foods. So the supply chain was very clear. And so we, Alf and the team knew very well how to get the fish from this remote region into the United States market. Mm-hmm. But now what we're doing is we want it to be available as food service recovers. I have to say, as communities come back, and our food service industry is always that first place. If you think about 9/11, the first thing that we wanted to do after this tragedy was over was get back to eating, sitting around a table together, connecting as a community together around a beautiful plate. And that's what we want for this beautiful fish, is to tell this story, essentially have this chain of well-being from the water all the way to this incredible experience that you would have eating it, that you know and understand all of the care. You can see and picture the farm, the people. And we want to be able to join you in that, in celebration, wherever you're living now in this time of trial in your communities, if it's supporting the food community, supporting it at retail to make sure you're getting good food at home. That's where Quarry Arctic wants to be.
Well, I want to make sure I can still get it.
So go to Whole Foods right now. You'll be able to get it at Whole Foods.
Okay. And so in New York, I can get it in Whole Foods then, just to be clear.
That's correct.
Okay. And what's the price point on the fish? How does that compare?
That depends on for Whole Foods. They are running it on a special price because they want to attract customers. So it's $9.99 or $10.99. I think it's in New York, but $9.99 per pound. So it's not.
That's very
not
reasonable.
Super expensive.
No,
yeah,
not at all.
But then again, others are selling it a bit higher. It's more. It's in the premium category. So it's. I have seen other prices that is around more around 16, 17 per pound. So
yeah, that seems more like what it the value or what it should be. $10.99 is very generous.
It's a commitment. It's a commitment to Whole Foods, though, and they have certain items. It happened as Amazon came in as owners, where they felt like they needed to be offering to their community items at a certain price point. And so we have a commitment to. I mean, the standards that Whole Foods has driven and the partnership that Alf and the team have really led with Whole Foods means that we want to stay committed to that. Where their director of sustainability, Carrie Brown. Their buyers, the entire team. It's a very important partnership to us. And so we want to be diverse. We want people to know what Quarry Arctic is doing. We want to be working with chefs and with other food service entities. But this partnership with Whole Foods is exceptionally important, and we'll continue to have that in some way.
Yeah. Okay. So last question before we wrap up, but I want to know for each of you, Alf, how you enjoy this fish. What's your favorite way to cook it? So Alf, is there a special Norwegian recipe you like to use with your salmon? Tell us.
Yeah. My favorite way to enjoy the salmon is, of course, raw. That's what I eat most of when it comes to salmon, just fresh and as sashimi. But also I baked in the oven, the options and the taste you can add on to the fish or with the fish is just amazing. So we cook a lot of that also. My kids are salmon lovers.
I hope so.
And they love the smoked salmon. That's the candy.
Yeah.
So So I'm lucky to have a father-in-law that smokes salmon and comes to the door with it for us. So
I just got a new load
yesterday, actually. So kids are happy.
Yeah. And Jen, how about you?
I mean, I have been a fan of the grill for many years. I was the spokesperson for Weber Grill, and I love that gorgeous kind of charred deliciousness that a grill and cooking over fire can bring. That could be, in my mind, that can be in a grill pan. If you're in an apartment in New York City, I've always said, you know, if I could only choose one pan out of the kitchen, I would put the grill pan on my back and off I would go. So whether it's the grill pan, the broiler, the grill outside, something where you can get that gorgeous caramelization on it. Salmon is very, very easy to cook. So for those that are listening that are just coming in and firing up their ovens or their stoves for the first time, as we look inward and we need to cook, this is something where a 6-ounce fillet, sear it on a very, you know, hot pan, a little bit of oil before you add the fish, season it with salt and pepper, get it in the pan, put it skin side down, let the skin get nice and crispy, turn it over, let it brown and really get golden brown, like the color of brown sugar, nice and golden brown on the top, and then take it off and enjoy it with a salad or vegetables. This is something so easy to have right now, especially during a time when we need delicious, nutritious food. So just keep it simple. The fish will stand up for itself.
Yeah, and don't overcook it. That drives me crazy.
And don't overcook it.
People overcook
salmon. It's so true, but this is a fish where it really is the meat lover's fish, and you can overcook it. It will not get dried out like a wild salmon will. There's enough fat in it, enough moisture in it. So what I mainly tell people is don't be afraid. Go in, pick up a little bit extra, freeze it right now in portions as you're building a pantry to have some stock and enjoy Quarry Arctic right now and we'll be there. It will be there right there with you, making sure that you've got good, healthy fish to be able to feed yourselves and your families and those you love.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you both so much for dialing in, for talking with me for well over, I think, an hour. I really enjoy learning more about everything, and stay healthy to both of you.
We absolutely will. And same with you, your family, and all of your listeners. We're so happy to support Heritage Radio. What an incredible project. Please let us know if there's anything we can do.
Thank you. I also want to give a big thanks to our sponsors. Our show engineer is Jeet Paul, and music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever you find them. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe, leave me a comment, let me know your think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.